now plugged into Action Features.
All right, here it goes.
Here it is, man.
We're recording.
We're recording right now.
Finally.
Is this maybe the first time where we've said we're going to do an episode the next time and we actually do that episode?
No,
we say we're gonna
no,
do the next time?
It wouldn't be the first time.
Really?
I'm sure there's been one in there because...
I don't know, man.
Well,
it seems like we have a bad habit of always going, next episode we're going to do the X-Men episode.
We do do that.
It's like three episodes.
We do that a lot, yeah.
Yeah. That's like our thing. That's what we do.
That's our thing.
Yeah.
It's our M.O. Same M.O.
Is that too loud? Is that TV too loud, you think?
It's picking up a little bit.
I'll turn it down
just a little bit. What are we playing on TV right now?
Oh, just a little film called Batman.
Oh, what's it called?
Batman.
Oh, why are we playing that?
Well, if you remember in last episode, Mike, we said, hey, next episode is going to be our Michael Keaton 1989 mm-hmm. Batman mm-hmm. episode, where we just talk about the 1989 Michael Keaton, Tim Burton, Jack Nicholson.
Kim Basinger.
Kim Basinger's. Batman film.
Alexander Knox.
Billy D. Calrissian.
The Billy D. film Batman. Well, I didn't know that.
What?
Why wasn't I told about this? Who's in charge?
Thank God, sir.
Oh, my God. Let's go.
That's one of our most used quotes in movies of all time. We love it.
Yeah.
So, here it is, guys. Mike and I are both huge fans of this movie.
Big fans.
So, we felt like we really needed to dedicate an entire episode to just talking about just this movie. So that's what this episode is. We're going to talk about our memories of the movie, favorite scenes, things we, just random stuff about the movie.
Things
just,
we hate about it.
There's nothing.
The parts that we hate.
There's nothing in there, buddy. There's nothing in there. So we decided to just throw the movie on, and we're just going to have our usual episode. We're just talking and things like that. And, if we catch something on the screen, we go, oh, we should really talk about that. That's happening right now. In the midst of all the other things we're talking about with the movie, then we'll do that. But there are two things we should talk about before this,
yeah,
because we want to get it out of the way.
Just brush up on a couple things, yeah.
You want to do yours first?
Yeah, I'll do mine first. It was I saw Oblivion.
Yeah,
over the weekend,
it.
Nate and I saw it. I was pretty sure it was going to be good, but I was really impressed by the film. I don't want to get too much into it here. I thought about writing a review for the website. I probably won't, so I'm just going to tell you guys if you're into science fiction for one, but. It's probably more science, like real science fiction than action. I mean, it's an action movie. It's got action in it. It kind of reminds me of Star Trek just a little bit.
It's a Star Trail?
A Star Trail.
Oh, all right. Mm-hmm.
But really well done. They built all the props. Not to say there isn't any CGI usage, but
there always is now.
But yeah, but it's done well. It's blended well. The scenery's beautiful, and there's an underlying theme. There's something deeper in the movie. It's not just like, hey, we're gonna shoot some lasers at some stuff. It's real thought provoking. There's a message in it, and
I've seen the trailer.
I know you have.
I've seen it.
You saw it.
I've seen the poster too.
You saw the poster?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
So
you
we're
saw
pretty
the
much
poster.
On the same level about this movie now.
So you've seen it.
Yeah,
you've
I've basically seen it. I basically saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my short review.
Plus, I saw one of the Mission Impossibles.
Did you?
I
the
saw
first,
one of them.
The first
yep.
one.
So
I have the action figures from that movie still.
One of the all-time worst action figures ever made.
I didn't buy them on purpose.
Yeah.
They were given to me as a joke from you guys.
Yeah, we gave
at
them
the
to
shop.
Me,
yeah.
me and Joe did.
You pawned them off on
we
me.
Did.
You stuck. You stuck me with a curse.
It's all good.
Just
I
like
want
the,
to see those again.
Just like the James Bond Jr. figures that are.
Oh,
sitting.
That was such a great time. We were so proud of that.
Yeah, those were fun.
All right. So my thing I want to talk about is that Reese Witherspoon is a real big piece of work, and she's a real piece of too. You guys have to have heard about this. With her getting pulled over and acting all, oh, you don't know my name?
Acting a fool.
You don't know my name? And say, I can get out of the car if I want to get out of the car. And all these different things. And then she comes out and apologizes and says, oh, I said some embarrassing things. Guess I had one drink too many.
Oh,
is that
it?
Okay, you're going to apologize for the embarrassing things, but the fact that you're a mother of three and you're cool with driving drunk, and drunk driving is okay,
it's cool.
Don't apologize for that. So then she canceled a bunch of appearances afterwards because I guess she doesn't want to deal with it. But I urge everyone that's listening to this to never, ever watch another Reese Witherspoon movie.
I don't
want to
deal with her.
I don't either.
You know what? She was on thin ice anyway.
Yeah.
With her face.
Let's give her the same treatment that Hollywood gave Mel Gibson.
Oh,
everybody
yeah.
should give her the same treatment.
Totally.
You know, she's out there driving drunk, or whatever, or with somebody driving drunk.
Yeah.
But they were both drunk.
Yeah.
And she's okay with him driving.
Getting out and mouthing off
and
trying to use your celebrity to...
Getting out and all this different stuff. Yeah, acting all mightier than thou, you know. Let's give her the same treatment. You know, after Mel Gibson's incidents with his drinking problem and things like that, let's give her the same kind of treatment.
That's what's funny about the whole thing is...
I'm already seeing people saying, oh, you know, we all mess up sometimes.
Right.
Let's give America's Sweetheart another chance.
Right. You want to know why? Because she didn't direct Passion of the Christ.
Yeah.
That's why.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's a double standard in Hollywood.
Yeah.
It really is.
It's crazy.
But I don't want to go too much on that. I just wanted to say that she's a real piece of work.
Grease. Grease Witherspoon.
Greasy Withered Spoon.
Yeah.
We won't say what we were saying earlier because it's a children's show. Right. This is children friendly.
It's for children.
All right, so let's get into it, man.
All right.
Now we're on the scene where Batman is dropped down. You got the two hoodlums.
I gotta say, this scene is
amazing.
This is an epic moment.
This was my number one movie moment, if you remember, was Batman.
That's right.
The punk's looking up. Batman getting revealed. The lighting is perfect. The ambiance is perfect.
Ambiance.
The music's perfect. It's just great.
I gotta say for an introduction to Batman, mm-hmm. I can't think of a better one.
You really
when he comes down in the background and it's real slow and you're just like, oh my gosh.
And he's not talking.
It's Batman, exactly.
He's not talking. And that's one of the things I have written down here is just his voice. And, you know, I don't want to get too far into bashing the Nolan
films. Yeah, let's not.
I'm not going to do that.
Go far
but down. You have to make some comparisons.
Sure.
You know, it's unfair to just not address it at all. Keaton's bat voice. I think it's perfect.
I do too.
It's not trying too hard. I watched a little bit of some Nolan stuff, and this is one of the only times where I will compare this to Nolan. And I'm going to try not to do that because I don't want to make anybody that really likes the Nolan films and that take on Batman feel like, oh, well, those guys.
This is positive.
Hate it.
This is our love.
The thing with Bale's bat voice is you can tell it's a fake voice. And he's trying to sound intimidating and gruff and mean, talking all the time like this. That is not a natural voice.
Not
and it's
at
being
all.
Used, and a lot of times he's screaming, like, swear to me, and all this different stuff. Whereas Keaton's bat voice is just enough. It's a different voice than his Wayne voice.
Yeah.
It's dark, it's raspy, but it's not over the top. And he's not screaming, he's just giving you just enough. Because Batman shouldn't have to use his voice
cool.
to scare you.
He's being cool.
Yeah.
Like, he's being calm, he's
which is scarier.
Right, he's in complete control of himself.
Yeah.
And
it's scarier when you don't say a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And you're not screaming it out.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's like, this guy is so calm. And just like, this is just another day, another night. This whole thing that's happening with me and him.
Right.
This criminal is thinking there. He's not saying a word. And then when he is talking, it's barely anything.
Right.
I just think it's perfect. It's a perfect voice for Batman.
It's perfect.
I love Kevin Conroy, Batman Animated Series voice.
Oh, yeah.
That's perfect, too. But they're kind of
we'll
in the same vein.
They
you
are.
Know?
They really are.
Where it's not over the top, and it's not putting on an effect in your voice to try and intimidate somebody. Because the Batman persona should be what's intimidating. Just the fact that this is a guy dressed up as a bat, this is Batman, that should do the job enough for you.
That should be enough.
That you shouldn't have to go over the top with the voice. And I also wanted to touch on real quick where he says there that I want you to do me a favor, I want you to tell your friends about me. Like you're saying, it's a great introduction for Batman, but it also kind of sets the tone that this city is so bad. And you saw in the beginning the panning shot of there's so many people and it just looks so corrupt and gross and crime filled, like New York times 10.
It's a city of justice.
Yeah, it's a city. No.
City of peace.
No, that's the R. Kelly song.
Yeah, that's what he's talking about, Gotham City.
Well,
So it is.
But he's going to use
city of love.
Yeah, there you go. He knows that he can't. On his own, stop everything.
Right.
So he's going to use the threat of Batman spread throughout criminals.
That's right. Let his legend grow a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Let the myth be bigger than the man.
Exactly. And that will do the job for him in a lot of cases, where he won't be able to go out and stop every crime. But if he goes and tells all his friends about this encounter he's had with this bat creature, more people will be scared and more grow. Just like when they were sitting there after what happened to Johnny Gobbs, they said that the bat got him. And so now they're talking about it. And another guy's going to talk about it. Another guy's going to. And his legend will grow.
Right.
So just with that little line there.
Striking fear in the hearts of criminals Gotham-wide.
Exactly. It doesn't have to spell it out for you. It's just enough told there that that's what he's doing.
Just like every brilliant thing, I think, in film or song or whatever, saying too much, explaining too much, treating the audience like they're dumb, you know, dumbing things down. Doesn't work. It always works more to pull back a little bit and just use the minimum. That's my own thoughts anyway.
And I want to say, you know, branching off that, Nick Meyer, who directed Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, mm-hmm. he was big into that. Like, to let the audience make their own interpretation of this, let them feel to be a part of it. But branching off of that and going back to the voice thing a little bit, when Ricardo Montalban came back to do Khan in that film, like his first scenes. I don't know, I'm talking about Star Trek and this is Batman, but it relates. When he first came back, his acting, he said it was all over the place. It was very loud and, mm-hmm. and thunderous and just way, it was over the top. Mm-hmm. And so he had to pull him aside and he said, you know, it was good. He said, but maybe you should just whisper, you mm-hmm. know, maybe whisper some of these lines yes. because you're showing everybody your top. And once you show everybody your top, you got nowhere else to go.
That's perfect.
You have
yes.
to stay there.
Exactly.
So that's an exact definition of how I feel about the Michael Keaton bat voice versus the Bale bat voice. Because he doesn't show you his top. He's just always there.
Right.
And so you're always wondering, is this guy going to snap? Is it going to go crazy right. or whatever? Whereas Bale, when he takes it to that level, he has to stay at that level all the time. And even when he's just talking normal, it seems ridiculous. Because he has to stay at that level all the time now.
Right.
Whereas I think that Keaton's got it down. I mean, the voice is down.
I do too. Let's step back just a second and recap. 1989.
Yeah, we should get into where it all started.
Yeah, 1989 comes around. First of all, we've got
those cookies, man.
We've got some.
Where'd you get these snickerdoodles?
Snickerdoodle cookies.
Where'd you get these?
Care of Nate Bauer's wife, Kelly Bauer, and their daughter Wren, bake these.
Goodness.
Now these are from Saturday, so I'm hoping that they're still good. They're in the bag.
They're perfect.
Perfect.
They're soft. They're delicious.
Oh, still good. So. Thank you, Kelly.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very kind.
Thank you, Little Wren.
Man.
For these cookies.
That's doing the job right
there,
man.
That's a good sugar cookie. All right. So 1989 happens, and a young 7-year-old Mike Beckett couldn't be more thrilled about this film coming out. And with this film came a host of Batman. It was Batmania, like I think we've said before, but it was Batmania. They started replaying the 60s
yep.
television show. There's Batman stuff everywhere. And I had already known about Batman because of superpowers. Like, I had all the superpowers when I was even younger. But I don't remember seeing this in the theater, but I had to have. Because I had everything. I was so excited about it. I saw the preview. I remember watching the trailer on TV.
Yeah.
And I thought that Batman had a sword because of that part with
the
sword fight.
Yeah.
So I had some Kinects. And I made a bat sword out of Kinects. It was weak.
Yeah.
It just fell apart because those
you wouldn't be able to fight anybody with it.
No, you couldn't. Yeah. I couldn't.
Yeah.
But I was so excited. And then that Christmas, I think I got the Toy Biz Batcave and the Batmobile. I think I had the Toy Biz did a Batwing, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
I had the handle at the bottom.
Yep.
That's the one. I had all those. I had all the figures. I was jazzed about it, man.
It was a great time, and there has been nothing like it since. That is the last of the great summer blockbuster event movies, I think.
Really? What else has there been?
You could compare Episode 1 in 1999, but even that didn't reach the levels of Batman. I mean, Batman was everywhere that summer. Everybody had a Batman t-shirt. People had, like, Batman haircuts. Batman was everywhere that summer. You couldn't turn on the TV without a Batman ad or news agency talking about Batman or the Prince Bat Dance video coming on. It was just Batman everywhere. And I was 10. I was going on 11 in 89. I was like you, pretty familiar with Batman. I had grown up with the Adam West show. And then, like we've talked about in the X-Men podcast, I would pick up comics. You know, nothing like picking it up every month, but I would pick up comics here and there. And so I knew Batman as a character from the Superpowers cartoon and from comics. And so I knew he was supposed to be darker than what he was in the Adam West show.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a revelation as I got older, like, oh, the Adam West show, it's fun, but it was really, for me, as when I was a younger kid,
it was different, yeah.
It's not what Batman should be. So when the scenes from this, like the trailers and magazine articles and things were coming out, I was thinking, wow, this is Batman, like the comic book Batman. This is a dark Batman. This is going to be really good. And so I got really excited about it. And I wasn't that into the Keaton controversy at the time. I remember the controversy more than my feelings of the controversy.
Yeah.
Like, oh my goodness, Mr. Mom's going to be Batman. I don't remember being that, like, worried about it. I remember reading all the worries about it, but not really knowing, like, okay, he's just an
right.
actor. What does it matter? He's an actor. And I'd seen Beetlejuice, so I
right.
knew Beetlejuice was good, and I knew he was good in Beetlejuice, so that wasn't really a concern for me. I did know Jack Nicholson, and I knew that he would be a cool Joker.
Yeah.
I was very excited about that. And so as the trailers came out, and the card set came out, and the magazine came out, it was just like this...
Oh.
This fever pitch of excitement. Oh, yeah,
you had
movie,
the cards.
Oh, my goodness.
I had no concept of that stuff whatsoever, and I don't remember seeing Michael Keaton in anything. I hadn't even seen Beetlejuice at that time, but I do remember seeing the TV spot and thinking, who's that curly-headed guy that's kissing the girl? That's Batman's girl. I'm sure of it. And I was upset about it because I didn't know. I didn't know. I couldn't make the correlation. But
the secret identity fooled you.
The secret. He fooled me. You. He got me.
Yeah.
But man, talk about proving people wrong.
Oh, my goodness. And I love that he would say that. He would say that on the award show. I just watched a clip from an award show the other night. He was saying something like, he said, so I just want to say to everybody that was sending me the letters and the notes about how I couldn't do it. Well, the best thing you can ever do is tell me, no, I can't do something, because I'll prove you wrong every time. Or something like that. And like Jack Nicholson was like patting him on the back and stuff. And he did, man.
What a great actor.
He took it home, dude.
He seriously did. That's what's so great about him. And I remember Tim Burton saying something about this. He's known for doing comedy and being sort of a little bit over the top, eccentric. You know, he's got those eyes that you can see a lot of things. That makes for a perfect translation for a comic book character, and all he did was pull it back, but all that stuff is still showing through. You can even see it in the bat mask.
Yep.
His eyes, his eyebrows, you know, like, are sculpted to match Keaton's face, and he just has those features. He's got the mouth and the jaw that come through. He's like, brilliant, brilliant casting, well, and just, I would have never thought it.
I wouldn't either. That was really genius, because, like you said, in Tim Burton interviews, he's talked about how he wouldn't have known how to put a big muscle tough guy in a suit, or like your usual leading man tough guy in there without it being a joke. You know, right. Like if you would have seen Arnold Schwarzenegger suited up as Batman, or even Sylvester Stallone suited up as Batman,
right.
It would have been kind of like, okay, this is kind of funny seeing him like that. But if you take a comedic actor that's a little bit off the wall and a little crazy seeming, and you put him in that bat suit, it works. You know, it's you could see that guy having the mentality to go out and do the things that he does.
Right.
You know, it was perfect. Perfect casting. Going back to the build-up to it, I remember seeing, and I think it was some like tabloid, the art, like a drawing of what Joker was going to look like the face. Because that was a well-kept secret for a while leading up to the movie. And I remember seeing that and just being like, wow, Joker is going to be creepy. And Joker is creepy. Like, their interpretation of Joker, and again, we're going to have to do a little bit of comparison here, but not really much. Well,
yeah, you have to.
Because they're two different entities. The Jack Nicholson Joker, to me, is Joker.
Oh, I think he blended every aspect of the different interpretations.
He's smart. He's crazy. He does jokery things that he finds funny. I mean, just like little things, like the doing the wah, as he's leaving from Vicki Vale's apartment, and the song he's like, kind of singing and the dancing around and making the weird noises when he's sitting there at the desk, the whoop. Whoop,
right,
and that kind of stuff.
That is a creepy scene.
It's super creepy. Yeah. And then there's the scenes where he like makes the Smilex commercial, and the dressing up as the mime outside City Hall to take out the other guy. It's just all very jokery things I can imagine the comic book Joker doing.
But still very dark.
Still very dark. Even
more dark than any of the competition might have done, because he's taking it so lightly. Mm-hmm. You think about the Smilex commercial. He killed those people.
Yeah.
Those people are dead.
They're dead, and he's laughing about it. He's having a great time.
He fries the guy
and
with
he's talking to him afterwards.
He fries the guy with the buzzer.
Yeah.
And I love
he has the live one here.
Yeah, he has the conversation with him afterwards, after the room is clear.
It's great.
I'm glad you're dead.
The scene where he's cutting up the pictures and just leaving them all around the room, it's just a bunch of cut up pictures. Why is he doing that?
It's a little bit twisted.
Super creepy.
It's a little twisted.
Yeah, but he finds it hilarious.
He thinks it's funny.
It's hard to stay inside the lines. it's great. I was focusing on Bob the last time that scene. Bob took the picture, right?
Right.
And so he cuts it out, and Bob's like trying to get a look at what he's done afterwards, like at the Vicki Vale picture. And I'm like, you took that picture, man. You know what he looks like.
He's probably upset that his work's getting
cut up. He was proud of that.
He's printing doubles, I think. Editing
focus. I know we're all over the place, but that's what we got to do with this.
It's going to be that way.
All over the place. Gotham City set.
Gotham's green.
Gotham's greed, I think is what you're trying to say there. Gotham's greed.
Mm.
But Gotham City set.
I always thought it was green because of the money.
No, it's greed because they're all trying to get the money.
It works either way, you think?
Maybe. Kind of. Possibly.
I mean, I've never watched it with subtitles, but
it's greed. Yep.
If it was green, it's covered in money.
Either one. Okay. Either one's fine. All right. We'll say either one's fine.
Okay.
I'm gonna say either one's fine.
It's fine.
But I'm talking about the Gotham City set.
Okay.
Man, I believed this was a city.
Oh, yeah.
Like, when it's filmed, Gotham City's a character.
It sure is.
It really should be. And it shouldn't just be, we'll film wherever works.
Right.
You know, oh, we'll film in New York. We'll film in Chicago.
We could make this fit.
Yeah, because that doesn't work. Because Gotham is worse than every city you can imagine.
That's right.
Gotham's the worst you can imagine. So you can't just go to Chicago, in my opinion, or go to New York or wherever and just film there. Because no matter what, you're just there.
Right.
It's kind of one of the things that checks me out a little bit sometimes on the Superman films, is they're not in Metropolis. It's a different time. Right. They couldn't really, like, I guess, build a Metropolis. Is that it's New York. They're mm-hmm. in New York. But this is Gotham.
Right.
I mean, to a T, that's Gotham.
Right, on its own.
I think it's fantastic, and I don't think it's been touched since then. I think Batman Returns had a good set, but it was a set.
Right.
Built on I can't remember which studio it is, but it's I think the Warner Brothers lot or something in L.A. But it's actually built at a studio.
It got a little bit more extravagant.
Yeah, for that one.
Just a little bit more, a little gaudier.
Yeah.
And also, I don't think it was as decrepit because it was around Christmas time.
Yeah.
And they made everything cleaner. And the thing about this set from the 89 movie is...
it looks dirty, man.
It looks dirty, but there's an underlying beauty. You can tell that there's a history mm-hmm. of beautiful architecture and a time when maybe the city wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
But it has gotten to this point.
Yeah, it's gotten horrible.
So there's a history involved without having to ever touch on it or say anything about it. It's already there. It's implanted, yeah. I think.
I totally agree.
It's telling a story. The set itself, the city itself tells a story without having to
exactly
tell a story.
That it's become so run down and just kind of overtaken by this horrible element that's there. And it just looks, I mean, it looks like if you cut yourself in a building, you'd be infected immediately. It's just right. like, it's just this monstrous place, you know? And I think it's perfect. It's a perfect set. And it hasn't been touched since, and I don't think it ever will be touched. Because nowadays, it would be location filming or CGI. Right. One of the two. Whereas they actually built that city.
Pretty much.
You know, and that's amazing to me.
At least some matte paintings, correct, for upper halves?
For upper halves, yeah. They built things up to a certain level and then matted it up right. from there. And then there's interior shots like Wayne Manor, which is not at that place at Pinewood. But Wayne Manor's great.
Wayne Manor's great.
So there's that. I like the fact, and I want to touch on this, that it's a long time into the movie before we find out Batman's origin.
Yeah.
You were saying it's a great way to open the film, and when I first started to watch the film, you're brought to this family, you know, and they're leaving the Monarch Theater, and it's a mom and a dad and a son,
mm-hmm.
and it's not until the son is named that you don't clue in that that's not, if you know Batman's origin,
right.
that that's not young Bruce Wayne and his parents,
right.
Which I think was a good way to open it, in
yeah.
that you kind of think it's them. But then you find out it's not them. And it's like, oh, okay, well, what's going on here? And then he's Batman, and he's saving them and all these different things. So it's kind of like touching on his origin a little bit, but you don't find out until later on what the origin is. And I think that's a great way to do a film. Whereas Superman, I love Superman. A good chunk of the first part of the movie is his origin and getting to the point where he's Superman.
Yeah.
This launches right in where he's been Batman.
Right. And then you only touch on that scene at the opening scene with the family coming out. Is like a foreshadowing. It's
exactly.
It parallels his story. And if you do know something about Batman's origin, you might be tripped up a little bit, but I didn't as a kid, and I never, you know. So looking at it from a slightly different perspective, it sets up to where you could see how that, like, Batman was there. Why he's at Crime Alley, why he's was particular, maybe wasn't particularly... set on stopping those criminals, but you know, it's personal for him. It's a personal thing
yeah.
for him. So looking back, anyway.
So right now we're happening with the Joker scene in Axis Chemicals. So we should probably talk a little bit about the Joker origin here.
Napier's cleaning out Axis Chemicals.
He's cleaning it out right now.
Yeah.
I like that this kind of relates to the Joker origin and him, you know, falling into Avada Chemicals and all that stuff, like in The Killing Joke, which had come out I think a year before this. And I kind of feel like that was really the defining Joker origin, The Killing Joke, where he's just like a normal guy that's down on his luck. He's got a pregnant wife and all this stuff, and he has to do this job for these guys, even after his wife kind of passes on. He still is stuck doing this job. He's really a hard luck case, and he's helping him break into the Ace Playing Card Company. And then he gets dropped into these chemicals, and he becomes the Joker. So he's basically an innocent guy that gets overtaken by these chemicals, that and all this stuff drives him crazy, and it changes mm-hmm. him and all these different things. And that's a cool... I love the Killing Joke, and it's a cool take for Joker's origin. But I have to agree with Alex Ross, who has also said that this take of Joker's origin is, in my opinion, better. I like the fact that he's a gangster yeah. and a hoodlum and just like a mean, evil guy.
And a smart one at that.
Yeah.
Which explains why he's able to organize things afterwards.
And this just pushes him off. It takes the filters off.
Right.
He's just now is even more evil and doesn't care at all.
Right.
And he finds humor in the things he's doing and just like it takes it to the next level. So you're taking somebody that's already not a sympathetic character and making him into an even more evil character that has no remorse.
Right.
And just, you know,
and the fact
is terribly evil.
And some people may not like this, but the fact that Batman was involved somehow, I don't know. It makes it, like, it works for this film. I would say in some other films, some other origins, I don't need everybody to be involved, but it kind of works for this because...
Look at that shot, dude.
It's great when Batman swings down.
They're scared of him.
Like, oh, yeah.
You would be scared. When he drops down, and I mean, even when the commissioner looks up and he's like, oh my God.
Right.
As he looks at him. I mean, that's scary.
Yes, it is.
It's a scary
look. I have to say, too, when he shoots him with the harpoon.
Yeah.
And he tugs on it, he gives it a pull. Like, even though he's not like, he's not out like doing a crazy martial arts, and he does some later, but he's not flipping everywhere or whatever, but he acts with such a physicality.
Yeah. And confidence.
I mean, just nailed it. He just nailed it. Anyway, I forget what we were talking about.
We were talking about...
Batman being involved in the origin. And, I mean, that's... I was young, so that's the way I know it. But it really kind of makes sense and sets up as to why... Well, there are other reasons why Batman would be Joker's archenemy, but they kill him off at the end of this movie. So it's really just like an issue of he's involved because... Like, Batman's evolved because he's a crime fighter.
Yeah.
But Joker's got a vendetta.
Yeah.
Specifically against him because of his thing.
Well, then we find out later in the film...
It works.
When Bruce clues in that it was Jack.
Yes.
That it was killed his parents. And that's a great moment. So, he's like, what?
Right.
As he's, like, looking at him, and he figures out that... So we should talk about that a little bit, because that was a big controversy at the time.
I'm sure it was.
Jack Napier killed his parents? Oh, that's terrible.
Right.
And if you look at it, Sam Hamm, who wrote this film... In his version of the script, that doesn't happen that way. But Tim Burton was kind of pushing for that. Like, we should really have him be the one that killed his parents. Yeah. And when the writer's strike happened and Sam Hamm was off the picture and wasn't able to do rewrites, Warren Scarron was brought in, and they put in the element of Jack killing the parents. And, you know, for me, it works. And I tell you why it works is that you've got an hour and a half to set up a story and make these two characters have a connection.
Yeah.
That would, you know, lead into this really dramatic fight at the end. So we find out that they both are responsible for each other's origins. Like you were saying, it makes the conflict at the end mean so much more.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's not like they eliminated Joe Chill. They've said, and Michael Uslan, the producer, has said the other guy that's with him is Joe Chill. And that's why he grabs the pearls, which is a big signifying mark of the Wayne's being killed as the pearls. So he's still there, but they've added Jack into it. And I think it works.
You know what? I can't say... If I was in charge now, or if I was making a decision, I'd be against it too, because on paper, it doesn't seem like it would work. It seems like too much, and a lot of other franchises have done a similar thing, and it hasn't worked. But it works
in my opinion.
In this movie, the way it's filmed, the way the reveal of when he does realize that it's Jack. It's not like, oh, you know, it's not like this obvious thing. It just works.
And it's a perfect moment for have the flashback of the origin. Too, that he's now, he sees that and he remembers that, and he's sitting there in the Batcave after looking at his face, and it's just kind of flashing back to it and remembering it. It really gives that moment, that origin moment, I think, in my opinion, a lot more emotional resonance, is that watching that and thinking about this is the guy. This guy that I'm been after is the guy that started this whole thing for me. And so that last confrontation at the end of the cathedral, I think, means so much more when you do that.
Yeah.
I mean, things get changed in movies all the time for that. And there is so much in this film that is Batman, and so much that is Joker, that a little, in my opinion, a smaller thing like that that's added into it really makes the movie work a lot more. Because comics have years and years and years to build up the relationship between Batman and Joker. Tim Burton had an hour and a half to build up this emotional relationship between Batman and the Joker. And they were coming from a place where, I mean, it's not like nowadays. Like, in the current films, you've got so much to build on. At this point in time, all we had was the Adam West series. Which pretty much made Batman camp for years. Every interview you see that leads up to this film coming out includes bow, piff, bam, wow. Wowzers, holy bat trunks, Batman. A new Batman's in the Batcave. And stuff like that. That was the that was everybody's thoughts of Batman. So he had to do so much with this film and change so much in the public perception that he had to pack it all in there.
And changed comic films forever.
We would not have Avengers, X-Men. Captain America, X-Men, all those films if it wasn't for this film right here. Because up until that point, we had the four Superman films, which the last two didn't do anything to help. Comic book movies at the, the movie theaters. And Swamp Thing, which also didn't do anything to help. At the movies. And no, Howard the Duck. None of those were helping anything. But Batman changed everything.
Well, it took the black, you know, which is a little bit overdone now. I wish they'd get some color back in. But it took the bat suit and made it acceptable for a film. You said something about the emotional resonance of the fight at the end because of Jack Napier and everything, and that I want to point out that there's a lot, at least enough, shots of Batman being emotionally reflective and being troubled in the, like, sitting in the Batcave, or maybe he's sitting at home or in the mansion or whatever, but those moments where he's sitting in the Batcave and he's in thought, that's something that's not done now in film, is just taking time with things and, oh, well, we don't want to waste time with him sitting around. Well, he's not sitting around. He's showing something about himself. He's showing something about the struggle that Batman is going through. And that's something that this movie does and does well, and I think there's enough of it. There's not too much of it. And it just builds that character, once again, without him having to say so much about it.
Exactly.
Perfect.
Plus, you really get a moody, contemplative Batman.
Which is how he would be.
Exactly. That's his character.
His whole thing is...
It's all he is. This tragedy that's made him has now just changed him the rest of his life. So even just little scenes...
Not only
that,
but the moral dilemma also of...
Totally.
You know, this and that, and now Vicky comes into the picture, and what's he going to do with her? Because how does she fit into a life, the life that he
has? This isn't what he had planned, and now she's here, and he's got to figure out how he's going to handle that. You know, and... I mean...
And then Alfred lets her in.
Let's in the Batcave. That's another thing that Sam Hamm has come out on record as saying. He's like, that was not in my script either. Alfred letting Vicky Vale in the Batcave was never a part of my script.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, okay. Again, we're talking about tying things up in an hour and a half. Yeah. You know, and there's certain things that you have to do in a movie because the public did not know Batman like this.
You know the actual runtime on this movie?
It's longer than an hour and a half. I think it's closer to two. To squeeze everything in, and you've got to take certain liberties. And Vicky Vale has figured it out by then. Yeah. She knows that he's Batman. Yeah. So without showing that scene, the only way to do that was have Alfred bring her in. Because, I mean, she's not going to show up there and Alfred's just going to go, by the way, Bruce Wayne is Batman. Come on down to the cave. Vicky had to have known something. And again, he's leaving that to the audience to figure out, okay, you have to figure out on your own that Vicky has this figured. After the whole thing in her apartment,
or she at least,
the metal with the bullet and all that stuff, she's got it figured out.
She at least has an idea.
He was coming there to tell her something. This whole thing happened. She's figured it out.
And you know what? I don't mind so much because at the end, she has to let go. Like, she likes Bruce, but she knows that she's letting go, and she's letting go for a bigger thing. And she walks away, and she feels a little bit safer. She kind of looks up to the sky, I think.
Parting shot.
And she knows that she made the right choice.
Yeah.
And she knows that it's got nothing to do with her. You know, she's not going to pout about it. No, you don't love me. You know, it works for that, I think. And I never really had a problem with her. Later on, it gets crazy because they start letting everybody starts knowing Batman's secret. They use the formula, but in this movie, it works.
I wanted to touch on one thing I always forgot on the whole Joker killing the parents thing, or killing his parents and all that stuff. And again, I think this was the other Nolan thing I wanted to mention. At the end of Dark Knight, Joker's going to this whole thing after he's been captured and talking about how we're destined to do this dance. You're just too much fun. You know, it's me and you or something like that. Where if you watch that whole film, why are they destined? He's just met him in this film.
Right.
He's just a crazy guy that he stops. Why are they destined? You know, that's the problem of trying to cram the whole years and years of Joker relationship into one film and then trying to say that they're destined to always fight each other.
Right.
You're trying to cram 60 years, 70 years of comics into that 1 hour and a half and try and make us believe that since Joker's been introduced at the beginning of the film, now they're destined to always fight or something like that.
Right.
Whereas this film, by tying their origins into each other, they really were destined to fight each other. Yeah. You know, that's true destiny, is that Jack has created him without knowing it, and then Batman has a hand in creating him without knowing that he created him.
Right.
So it all ties back together again. I just wanted to put that out there before I forgot to say
it. I hadn't thought about that, but
it
makes sense.
So I'm just looking at my sheet here just to make sure we're not missing anything.
No,
this scene's happening right now. I wanted to talk about this. Okay, so Jack has survived the chemical dump. He's had the shrapnel to the face, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes to the surgeon, right? And the surgeon says, "You see what I have to work with here?" And he's done his best to put Jack back together again.
Tried.
So this is still kind of a little bit confuses me to this day. What did the surgeon do? Like, is he the one that made the smile? When I first was like, well, did he make the smile? But then the Smilex gas makes the smile. So I'm curious what the surgeon did. You know,
the Smilex gas was something that was in that vet, I'm sure. So he probably had it. I kind of figured that his... something had eroded, or maybe it got burned through, and the surgeon really was just kind of doing patchwork. I don't think he crafted the smile.
Yeah, because I mean, you see the smile exactly later on after the people do the cosmetic stuff,
right?
And that could be something with Jack and his chemical stuff that he creates that on top of it, because his chemistry, whatever. I've always wondered, like, okay, so what exactly did the surgeon? Because it's kind of implied that he did his best with what he had left. But he ends up looking exactly like those smile people later on. So that's always been something I've thought about with this film. This scene's great.
Oh, Jack Palance.
Oh, this scene's great.
He
just keeps shooting him. He's beyond dead. And he just keeps shooting and laughing and laughing.
He's having a good time.
This is one of Jack Nicholson's favorite scenes, too.
Oh, okay.
And this is a film he'll watch again and again, Jack has said.
I love the idea of Jack Nicholson sitting around watching Batman.
He loves himself as Joker.
I
would too.
I would watch it all the time.
He said he wouldn't watch the dailies for this film, like at first, because he was a little worried about how he was taking things kind of over the top. He felt like, I just let myself go.
Yeah.
He said things that I would catch myself saying, "Don't do that. That's too over the top."
Yeah.
And other films that I would just do it.
Right.
Just do crazy things. And he said, so I wasn't watching the dailies at first, but then John Peters and Peter Guber, the producers, and Tim Burton said, "You got to come in and see these dailies. You have to see this." You have to come in and see it. And he saw it, and he's like, okay.
Wow.
And right then I knew it worked.
Wow.
And everything I was doing was working.
Something I love about this, with Jack Palance, when they show him, his desk is framed in front of this large window, and you see just the faces of the statues on the outside of the building.
Yeah.
In this movie, there's not a whole lot of sculpture and statue. And later on, like...
Returns,
there's a lot more.
Yeah.
And then Batman Forever is over the top with it.
Yeah.
But in here, you just get a tiny little taste of, you know, he's in a nicer apartment building. He's in a nicer high-rise, and it adds a certain sophistication to where he is. And it's just in the background. It's just a little bit, but it's...
And something I didn't notice for years is that his clothes are all kind of...
Torn a little bit?
Torn
little
up.
Tattered?
His gloves are kind of torn up, and his outfit's kind of, you know... marked up where it's the same clothes that he's, you know, he hasn't changed his clothes since the whole thing went down. He's still wearing the same outfit that he wore when he went into the vat of chemicals.
Which, you know, when I was younger, I just kind of assumed it was that same night, but it really wouldn't be. He's probably been
he's
on
the
lam,
surgery,
you know.
He's been
out for
a
while. This is a weird thing coming up where.
He's
hanging upside down like a bat, and I don't hate it at all.
I think it's like an exercise thing though.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, obviously it shadows the fact that he's like a bat.
Yeah, you can buy one.
Yeah,
like you can go out and buy one right now. But
I think it was just put in there as a weird kind of just to show that he's a weird
just
dude.
A little and Vicky wakes up and sees him in the middle of the night. And she kind of just doesn't really know what to make of it, but I love that. And if I was Batman, I would want to do it too because my spine would be compressed.
Oh, no doubt.
You'd have to hang upside down.
You'd be messed up all the time.
You'd have to hang upside down.
And I mean, a lot of people make fun of the fact that the neck doesn't move on the suit, that he has to do the turn. I love it.
I love it.
I think it adds to his character that he's moving like that. Like everything,
every
movement is deliberate.
Yes.
It's just kind of, and I would much rather have a neck that looks like that than some kind of weird segmented neck. And I'm not saying this to harp on that, But where we got that Dark Knight suit where he's, his neck's able to move, it looks like a turtleneck to
me. Yeah, he looks... And it makes the head look bigger.
Exactly.
Like, it looks bulbous. It looks...
I'd rather have something that looks good.
I would, too. And you know what? I didn't notice the turn for a long time.
Me too.
I just kind of thought, you know...
That's what
he's
Batman
awesome.
Is.
He's acting... Like, yeah. His everything makes up for that.
And it adds to the visuals.
Yeah. We're getting wrapped up in watching this, but this scene where Joker is sitting at the desk... And what do you do with the body? You know it's probably just like sitting
just
right
sitting
by
there.
The desk.
He doesn't care. He's just going to leave it there.
He needs to read the paper first.
Yeah. Another thing that I wanted to say here, we're looking at Bruce and Vicky. I like that Knox doesn't recognize Wayne. Yeah. Vicky doesn't recognize Wayne. Nobody really recognizes Wayne other than the ones that absolutely would have to recognize him. Like Commissioner Gordon would probably recognize him. And that's telling, too, that he doesn't want to be in the limelight. He doesn't want to take any chances that somebody's going to recognize him as Batman at some point.
Right.
So he kind of, it almost seems like he deliberately stays out of the limelight. Because Knox is, I mean, a major reporter in Gotham.
He's a reporter, yeah.
Bruce Wayne's like a major dude in Gotham. He would recognize him. Vicki Vale's like this famous photographer lady, and he's like one of the richest men ever.
Mm-hmm.
You would recognize him.
You'd think you would.
Not here, because he kind of, I think, does his best to stay out of the limelight.
It adds a little bit to the mystery, too. Whatever you think of the Batman story or the character in general, for the film... It adds to that mystery and not having everything be too easy.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing, it's not too easy, you know. Oh, Bruce Wayne.
There he is. Yeah.
You know.
That, and it also could play into, I can't remember where I read it. It may have been one of the books or something like that. Apparently, this film, according to at least the one thing I read, he had been Batman for about 6 weeks at this point when this film takes place. So, before that time, was he off training? Was he off doing this? Has he been gone for so long and now he's just back at Gotham in the last past 6 weeks? And that's why everybody doesn't recognize him? Again, that's one of those things that it leaves you wondering and leaves you to fill in your own little plot, if you want, to say why the people don't recognize him.
Right.
These people that should recognize him don't recognize him as Bruce Wayne. I love little things like that.
They're
thrown in the movie.
Yeah.
Just, you know, just little things, just little decorations, basically, to the film that you can extrapolate from and come up with your own storyline. I love the fact that Joker paints himself.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome.
To kind of...
He's not going to... Look at his face.
I mean, yeah, you know he's not going to blend in, but he's...
He's still making an attempt at it, but he's still wearing his, like, Joker-y type clothes and...
It's probably fun. It's a game to him.
It's a game, yeah. Just like the Joy Buzzer thing here is... It's all funny to him. And that's what makes this Joker, Joker. I mean, you can portray any character and do a great job of portraying it. And I'm not going to name names here.
Mm-hmm.
You can do a great job of portraying it. But if it's not Joker, you're not a great Joker.
Right.
You're just a guy that played a great character.
Right.
Or an actor that did a great job of doing something.
Right.
But this is Joker. What Jack is doing right here, like electrocuting the guy and making, oh, hoo, 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 hoo. And throughout the film, it's Joker. He does Joker-y type things.
Mm-hmm.
If you change the Joker character to the point where he's not the Joker anymore... What's the point? That to me is not Joker. The thing I love about this film is it's a comic book film. It's not afraid to do comic booky type stuff.
Yeah.
Stuff that doesn't work in the real world, but that works great on a comic book page. Or that can convey into a comic book. That's what I think is great about it.
That's part of the benefit too of doing the set like you were talking about and having the city be a character in and of itself. It's not so far fetched. It's almost like Dick Tracy was handled a little bit.
Oh,
where
yeah, definitely.
You're in a fictional world. It's not. You know, you see the guys with the crazy faces, and you don't think...
You don't think twice about it.
Oh, that's silly. It's a comic book. You're watching a comic movie based on a comic book.
Could a chemical do this to somebody's face? No.
Probably none that we know of.
Not in real life, probably, but
no,
it
not
works,
in real life.
Because it's a comic book. And that's great. Could it dye his skin white and turn his hair green? No, but it's a comic book.
Well, if you
want... That's what I want to watch.
If you want to get into... To all that, you can just pretty much, you can do away with all the superhero movies, because you don't get struck by lightning and have speed or whatever.
I like the fact that this film is not afraid to be a comic book. And at this point in time when this film was made, there was no comic book movies. There was a great fear of doing a comic book as a movie.
Yeah.
But you know what? They went for it. They were just like, you know what? This story works and we're going to do it this way and people are going to love it. And that's just all there is to it. That's the way we're doing it. We're not going to try and do Batman is a real-world vigilante or something like that,
right,
all these different things. But they made a comic book movie, and I appreciate it, and I love it. I mean, it's my favorite film of all time.
Tim Burton, it is peak. I mean, I haven't cared for anything he's done the past few years, but, you know.
This and Batman Returns.
It took somebody like him to to see the potential in something just a little bit off, you know?
Yeah. I wanted to talk to a little bit more about everything surrounding the film, too.
Yes, let's do that. We're at 45 minutes.
Okay.
I was hoping we'd get to some things.
Just like an incredible amount of merchandise.
Everything.
An incredible amount.
I had toothbrushes, shampoo, I had a soap.
It has to help
a
the
soap
record.
Tray, a soap dispenser.
I mean, Star Wars has been a juggernaut for years, but I'm talking one film in 1 year.
Yeah.
The amount of merchandise tied to this film to come out with its opening. It's got to be like a record.
It was everything.
It was everything, man.
Glasses.
Everything. Converse Chuck Taylor All-Star shoes and, like you said, toothbrushes and window clings and, like, car things to keep your interior cool.
Tie-ins to all kinds of...
Tons of stuff, man. You could get anything you wanted, Batman.
Food franchises. Anything.
What was your... I mean, obviously the toys were a huge part. Now, I want to talk about that real quick, actually, before I was going to say what you're going to say. I remember... trying to find the toys, the three Toy Biz figures.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Johnny's Toys. They had no Batmans left. All they had was Joker and Bob the Goon. And so all I could get was a Joker. And I had to use... I'm pretty sure I still had my superpowers Batman at that point, and I was using it to play, you know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until quite a bit down from the movie coming out that I found a Batman at Value City and got a Batman to go along with my Joker. And then by that time, we were, you know, a little past that, we started to get into the Kenner figures, which were superior figures.
Yeah.
But man, not being able to find the main character, that's how crazy it was. You couldn't find a Batman in the store. It was just crazy, dude. What was your I'll go back to it. What was your favorite merchandise type of the film?
Aside from the toys, I had... well, this is an offshoot. I had a belt, you know, a role play.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Bat belt with the gun. I was a little particular about things, so I wanted the one that had the dart gun that looked like the one in the movie.
Yeah.
So that's the one I had. I had a, and I still have to this day, a Batman. This was not a movie tie-in, but it was out during that time. It's about 2.5 feet tall wall light. You've seen it.
Yeah, I've seen it. I used to have one.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I've never seen one. I've looked on eBay. I've never found one. But it's you know, it's molded. It's like a 3D.
It's like him walking forward in the blue and gray outfit.
Right, in the blue and gray outfit. And it's a 3D thing. It just has a little light in it. But I had that in my room for years. I had everything. I had a bedspread, a comic book bedspread. And then I had a Batman Returns themed thing, I think.
We'll have to do a whole thing on Batman Returns.
That's a whole other thing. But I can't remember. I was an action figure kid. And like I said, I had all the vehicles in the Batcave, but...
I was all about the action figures, but I also loved those Topps trading cards. Those Batman trading cards.
I had a lot of those trading cards.
And that movie magazine. I loved that movie magazine. I remember getting it, and it was a day that my dad was doing... I've already told this story on the podcast before. I don't even know. I remember getting it that day, and I vividly remember that we were taking care of some kind of walk-a-thon type thing at his work, where we had to be at stations to check people off. And I knew I was going to have to be there the whole day, and my dad said, well, do you want to get something at the grocery store or something to read for the day? And I saw that movie magazine. I was like, I have to have this. This is it. And I would take that magazine everywhere. Everywhere I went, I would take that magazine with me. And I remember me and my sister were doing some yard sale, and we were fighting about something, and she took the magazine and threw it, and it tore.
She tore it.
I could still see it in slow-mo in my mind of that magazine flying through the air and it tearing and just being like, no. Because, I mean, you can't just go buy another one 8 months down the line or something. It was gone.
It's gone.
So those were two big ones. And the Batman the Serial, which we've talked about before. I loved Batman the Serial.
Yes.
So it's not really merchandise, but it was a major time.
Which we ate for its 10-year anniversary.
No good. I almost forgot that I didn't say when I first saw it. You were talking about how... my parents, and I probably told this story on the show before too, but if you haven't heard it, then it's new to you. I remember my parents doing this thing where they marked a spot on the calendar and they said special day. And it was marked on the calendar, oh, special day. And me and my sister were just going nuts, like, what is this special day? What are we doing? And, oh, we can't tell you. It's going to be a special day. And I remember they put us in the... My dad drove a pickup truck at the time with a camper on the back. And we sat in the back of that and they said, you guys lay down on the back and don't look out where you're at. And we'll just, when we get there, we get there. And I remember driving. I so vividly remember laying there with turning to my sister, being like, "What do you think we're doing? Where do you think we're going?" And both of us just being like, "I don't know," you know. And I was almost 11 at the time, and my sister was 12, almost 13, something at the time. And I remember my mom knocking on the back window thing, and her pointing out to the sign and seeing the Oakley Drive-In sign with Batman, and had Batman symbols on the sign. And I freaked out. I was like, we're seeing Batman! Because it wasn't like you went to the movies all the time when we were kids. Yeah. It was kind of a rare thing you went to the movies. Yeah. And so I was just freaking out. I was like, I can't believe we're seeing Batman! And so my sister and I sat on top of the truck, and we had the radio, because you had to tune in the actual radio. And about halfway through the movie, the sound went out. I was just distraught. I was like, and I just stayed there. I was like, I want to keep watching it. My dad was like, we can't do this. Yeah. You can't. I don't. I know how much you were looking forward to this. I don't want your first experience of this movie to be
without sound.
Yeah. And so he let me stay, I think, for another 15 minutes past. He's like, but I'm not letting you stay for the end. He's like, it's just, I'm not going to let that be ruined for you.
No.
And then we left, and then I didn't get it to see it until it was on VHS. Until after that.
I had the VHS tape. I don't think I still have it. But, man, I wore that thing out.
Me too,
dude.
Me too, brother. I watched that thing nonstop.
The case was all worn out. I watched it all the time. I had friends sleep over. Hey, what do you want to do? Let's watch Batman, because you know that's what I want to watch. They wanted to watch it, too. That thing was worn out.
Oh, dude.
And at the beginning, where they had Daffy Duck come on, and he's talking about the Warner Brothers ball cap, for the longest time, as a child, I thought he was saying the Warner Brothers bull crap. I thought it was so funny. It was so funny to me.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers bull crap. What?
I didn't
get it.
I loved those commercials, but at the same time, it was like...
And the Coca-Cola one.
You had to wait through them. Because you don't want to fast forward the little
bit. I know it was like half the time or something, but it took a little bit of time to fast forward through.
It wasn't a fast process, without a doubt.
I would just put it in. I wasn't even concerned about not waiting for things. Like, I don't know. It was just a weird time. You put the tape in, and that's it.
That was it.
That's it. I'm going to go get popcorn. Yeah. This is happening or whatever. You let it play.
It was one of the only VHSs, too, that I felt like had ads at the beginning. And I'm sorry if I'm turning it off.
We can hear you.
It was one of the only ones, I think, that had those ads at the beginning. I don't remember a lot of other VHSs having, you know, like that kind of advertisement that was directly tied to the film.
Yeah, I can't remember. I can't remember.
It was very,
mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
Very interesting, those ads. There was something else I was going to say about that. I remember my dad bringing home that VHS and us having Hot Pockets that night and just being like, he's got Batman. He brought Batman home. It was the same kind of feeling as seeing it at the drive-in that one time. Yeah. It was a moment. Mm-hmm. And it was an event, you know, to watch this movie and to have this movie and to go see this movie. Whereas no movie now is like really an event.
Well, we get so much.
Yeah.
And like you said, at the time, there was no comic movies at the time like this. And it was on its own in that year. I mean, for a kid, the movie was over the top for me to watch. But because it was a superhero film...
You got away with it.
I was allowed to watch
it. Yeah, because you had a different... I mean, it was a different thing with you and your parents.
I was a little bit younger.
Yeah,
and
you were only allowed to watch certain...
My mom was pretty lenient about it, but she didn't like...
Your dad wasn't. Was he?
No, he was, but... It's hard to explain.
Okay.
It's hard to explain. Yeah. It was certain things. Certain things. My mom didn't like the cursing, and...
Yeah.
My dad didn't like the superhero thing.
It was a film everybody had to see.
Yeah.
Everybody had to see it. It wasn't one of these films where there's a certain audience for it, but everybody had to see Batman.
Right.
Everybody was going to see Batman. It was the talk of... Everybody talked about it. It was just the film. It was an event. And I've tried to kind of... And I'm going off on a little tangent here, but it's the one film... Well, it and Batman Returns is the one film that I have not let Blaze watch, and I'm not going to let him watch until he's the same age I was when I saw it.
Yeah.
And I've tried to build it into an event, because it's the only film I saw great films as a kid. I saw Indiana Jones and the Star Wars films and all these different things, but it's the only movie I can remember really building up to, and it really being an event for me. And kind of like that time in my childhood, 10 going to 11, you're changing. You know, you're a different person than you were. I mean, you're younger than me, but it was a time where it was... Okay, I'm not having as much imagination and make-believe type stuff as I was before, and I'm starting to understand other things more as a teenager now. And so I thought that was the perfect time for Blaze to see this film, and I didn't want him to have this film be like other films where you just watch it over and over again as a kid and it loses its magic, you know, and it loses its luster, and it's just, oh, that's a film I watched a bunch of times. It could still be great, but you've watched it a ton of times, and it doesn't mean quite as much. You know, but I wanted this to be an experience and to be a memory and to be something that he could look back at.
I agree.
And, you know, enjoy. There's tons more on this list, but I mean, we're an hour into it.
Yeah.
This shows how much you can talk about this film.
We haven't talked about the Batmobile yet.
We haven't even talked about the Batmobile yet. The Batmobile's amazing.
It's a great design.
It's a perfect design.
I love it. I love the 60s Batmobile.
Yeah, it's great.
I love the 80s incarnation, most of them, from the comics and whatnot. But
this Batmobile.
Once again, this one to me was...
It's the top, man.
It was at the top. It was so cool. Yeah. It was so cool looking.
It's a really, really cool Batmobile. It's and the art, the shields. I don't think, again, like Gotham City, I don't think this Batmobile has been topped. I don't think it will be topped.
Right.
It's a great design for a Batmobile. Right. This is what the Batmobile should look like throughout all incarnations. There's nothing wrong with it. It's perfect. And the Batman the Animated Series kind of takes its design a bit from it.
That cartoon borrows a lot from
it definitely does.
Films,
you can see the influence.
Which we will talk about
when we get to the Animated Series episode. We could almost do a continuation of this episode into Returns and touch on the things we didn't touch on here.
Okay, we can do that.
Which I think is fair. You know, I mean, to Returns is it's kind of the sister film to this, obviously.
It really
so
is.
It's
we can do
a
that.
Lot of things we didn't touch on here, since we've already gone an hour. We could touch on in that. I didn't turn my ringer off. I don't know
but it was the Batman theme song, so it was okay.
It's okay.
It's okay.
It's fine.
It's okay.
It's fine.
It's okay.
All right, so I think that's enough for this episode, right?
Yeah. Let's do a two-parter.
We'll do a two-parter.
What?
Let's do it. We'll do the next episode.
Action Features Returns.
There we go.
I just came up with that
on my own. I'll keep the sheet, and we'll talk some more about this. We'll finish this one off, and then we'll talk about Returns, too.
That sounds great.
I think it's a good idea.
That's great. Okay, right. So head over to 1989batman.com.
Hey, thanks, man. That's a plug for my fan site.
Our sister. That's our sister website.
That's a sister website.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's really just James doing it. But there's tons of good information. Just put up... Is the last thing you posted about the set?
Well, I did a couple quick posts after that, like little videos and things like that.
Well, there was
a big post about the
set.
There's
a big post about the set and these guys that took pictures there, and James has done a lot of work going in and finding out exactly the layout of how
of the entire set,
how everything was laid out.
Horn.
I know you wouldn't have, but I'm tooting it.
Thanks, man.
I'm tooting your horn for you. Because
you
put it...
Ayo.
Okay. Okay, maybe...
I did put a lot of work into that.
I can tell.
Yeah,
I mean, it's obvious. You put
it was a lot of staying at home and freeze framing.
Crap load of work into
movie.
So it's pretty interesting. It's cool. And
big thanks to Mark Jones, who's the guy that let me use those pictures to figure out the layout. It's basically just taking the Pinewood Gotham City set from this guy's pictures he took from where he visited the set and figuring out the layout of Pinewood, how Gotham City was laid out. And how the filming took place and stuff. It was interesting to me to figure it out. So
I think it's pretty neat because, you know, there's the correlation between certain locations that in your mind in the movie are totally separate and they're really just around the corner
really
or across the street from each other.
And even though the set is massive,
it is amazing
to see what's close to each other.
Yeah.
And he was very nice and sent me, he had picked up a couple things while I was there and he sent me a couple things in the mail today, and it was quite nice of him, and I really appreciate it, Mark. If you happen to be listening to this podcast, thank you for the use of the pictures, and thank you for the wonderful treat you sent me. So, there's that.
Awesome.
All right. So we'll see you guys next time. Same bat time.
Same bat channel.
Yes. You see what we did? I think it's cool.
Action Features.